Hello and welcome to the Hardwood Paroxysm Podcast. I am Robbie Callan. Joining me today is Bo Cherney. Bo, how are you doing today?
Doing solid. How are you?
Good. I'm doing all right. Georgia State lost a heartbreaker in the Sun Belt Championship today, so a little down on that, but
that's unfortunate.
We'll work through it.
At least your college team was in a championship game.
Go Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
all right. Well, we're here to talk NBA basketball, and actually we'll probably end up talking a little college basketball towards the end. But we're going to start out, we're going to get the veggies out of the way first and talk Eastern Conference playoff race.
East is big, man.
Tell him, Woody. Tell him. Speaking of Woody, the Knicks are charging, if we can use that word.
I mean, they've won what, six straight? I guess that counts as charging. I mean, they've put together solid stretch of games. I mean, they haven't really played a bunch of good teams, but I mean, they are beating teams I guess they do consider that they should beat.
It's kind of funny. The Hawks lost 14 out of 15 over a stretch, and I mean, they dropped out of, like, the 4 seed to the 8 seed, but they lost 5 in a row and almost lost no ground on the 8 seed at one point. And now the 7, 8, 9, and 10 teams in the East all have 2 or more game winning streaks, which is so weird. the Bobcats have won 4 in a row, Hawks have won 3 in a row, Knicks have won 6 in a row, and the Cavs have won 2 in a row. So, I don't know. Maybe they've been picking on the bottom of the East and the West at this point. Jeez. The East is so bad.
It is. It's kind of depressing.
It's really bad. I mean, we were both at the Hawks-Nuggets game last night where the Hawks won their 3rd straight. The Hawks are healthy now, so I think they've got kind of a hold on that 8 spot. I don't see the Knicks making up 3.5 games. But I guess you never know, but the Knicks are kind of playing a little out of their minds right now, aren't they? Like, shooting the ball? I feel like it's not the same.
They're ridiculous. And here's they've got several days off, but don't they have, like, a bit of a tough schedule coming up?
They've got a Western road trip that the Hawks pretty much just got off of. The Knicks, I know they've got a West Coast trip.
They play Indiana on Wednesday. And then,
that's no fun.
And then they actually have a light schedule after that. They have Philly, Cleveland, the Lakers, and the Kings.
Oh, well, that's not much of a West Coast.
Yeah, but then they're West Coast, and then they have Phoenix and Golden, add Phoenix at Golden State.
Nah, there it is, yeah. Man, the Lakers are awful. First team to be eliminated from the playoffs.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Lakers fan. Tank for Wiggins, baby.
It's so awful to be a Lakers fan right now.
Oh, man, it's always rough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Feels so bad for them. They never get it right there.
No. For so long.
But Charlotte's been impressive this year. I think honestly, as it is now, I don't see Cleveland nor New York fighting their way into the playoffs. Detroit has fallen off the face of the earth. They are really a bad basketball team.
Terrible. I mean, I don't understand.
No one does. I mean, they've got their lineups are. I don't understand why they decide what they do with their lineups.
I don't understand. I mean, that all starts with signing Smoove, which is still, I don't understand that at all.
I love Josh.
I do too.
And I've said this many times. He's one of my favorite guys in the league. But he makes no sense for them.
No. It's...
Like, if they weren't going to move Monroe, which apparently they decided not to, I don't understand what the point of that Smoove signing was. It's just, they're really brutal to watch. Jennings is just out there chucking at this point.
I mean, that's like, Jennings at all points. It's just out there.
Well, I feel like Yeah, I feel like when he's on a good team, or a decent team, like when the Bucks used to be kind of in that 8 seed range and he was on there, like there would be times where he would kind of at least pretend like he was playing point guard.
I mean, what and, was like, it? They
facilitate some.
They made the playoffs year before last, right?
Correct.
This lockout season, he had a pretty good season that year. I feel like.
He did. He did. But, yeah, I mean, when he's on a bad team, he's just that kind of guy that he just starts putting it up. A gunner after Zach Harper's heart. and then, yeah, I mean, the Knicks, they're like the fourth best offense in the NBA since Bargnani got hurt. Which, I mean... Chris Herring tweeted that out today.
Grab game CAA.
They, yeah. And for whatever reason, they're like, I think they're now 10th, top 10 in the league in offensive rating. They were like 17th before the Bargnani injury. The Knicks baffle me almost as much as the Pistons do. Like the lineups, almost not quite. Just because, like you look at the Pistons and you're like, they got talent. They've got like Drummond. Josh Smith is a good basketball player when you put him in the right positions. This year he's like the worst 3-point shooter in the NBA.
Ever.
Like he's shooting like 24% or something like that. It's so bad. 25%, I think, is what he's at. I don't understand why they keep putting him out there and letting him... Like, if you watch them play, there will be sets where he is just standing behind the three-point line. Like, that's his job, is to be the floor spacer. That should never be Josh Smith's job.
No. Absolutely not. I mean, he
should be cutting. He should be... in the post against smaller players, if you're going to play him at the three. Like, that's how he worked in Atlanta at the three. He used to dominate Paul George.
I mean,
it's hilarious.
Atlanta also
that.
Had Al Horford.
Right. And that's the difference. Is like, you could put Josh in the post and spread Horford out to like 15 to 18 feet, and there's a threat there. You put Greg Monroe out there, people will happily let him catch the ball 15 feet from the basket and shoot.
Right.
So you can't put Josh in the post, but I haven't even seen him try. I don't know. Detroit baffles me.
And you were right. The Knicks are 10th in offensive rating now.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, but Mike Woodson's a defensive coach.
Well, you know, I mean, he was an assistant on those Detroit teams. So, you know, he's got to be a defensive coach. Right?
Just like when all those Atlanta teams with Josh Smith and Al Horford couldn't finish in the top 10 in defense.
Woody.
I mean, people slammed him for ISO ball in Atlanta, but they were second in O rating in their 53 one year.
I mean, it works when you have the right pieces. Like, that was when Joe Johnson used to tear it up.
Yeah.
But it...
I mean, it's terrible to watch.
No, it's brutal to watch. I mean, Mike Woodson teams are some of the worst teams to watch just because there's nothing fun about them. Like, defensively, they're ragged. And then offensively, it's just boring basketball.
Yeah.
Like, the only excitement comes when they make weird mistakes.
Yeah.
Which the Knicks do regularly, but... I think Hawks end up in the 8 seed, which, if they do that, they need to hope that the Pacers stay in the 1 seed. I mean, it's not like they're going to win a series, but they could take a couple games.
Yeah, they beat the Pacers once this year already.
Yeah, they could take a couple games from Indiana. I don't think they have much of a chance against the Heat in the playoffs.
No.
Miami just all of a sudden flips that switch and LeBron starts killing people. And it's not good.
I feel
I feel like
the Hawks aren't going to win that matchup with Indiana, but with if you have Pirro out there as your starting center, and you're forcing Hibbert out that far, and if Pirro's hitting, that could cause a couple of problems for a couple of games.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I mean, there's no chance the Hawks really take anything in Indiana, but...
Oh, no.
they might snag a game or two at home. Against Miami, I don't see them taking more than maybe one game if the Heat decide to sleepwalk through, like, a game four or something.
Yeah. Gentlemen sweep.
And then, you know, the Bulls are somehow still just plugging along. They might snag the 3 seed from Toronto, who just lost today.
Yeah, that's why I wouldn't want us to move up. If we moved up to 6 and had to play the Bulls, I'd just quit.
The two teams the Hawks cannot afford to play are the Bulls and the Nets, as weird as that sounds.
This play's so awful against them.
Horrible. I would rather see the Heat than the Bulls.
At least they have. I was about to say, at least if we're playing the Heat, we get to see LeBron.
That's fun. The Bulls are worse to watch than the Knicks.
They are. I mean, the only redeemable thing is you get to see, like, Joakim Noah get hyped a couple of times.
Like, the most exciting thing I've seen on a Bulls game this season is Yannick Noah going crazy watching Joe. Like, that's it. That was the most exciting thing I've seen. Or maybe Mike Dunleavy getting gashed open and then coming back and making a bunch of threes. But other than that, they're horrible to watch. They're a really good basketball team. But they're really bad to watch. It's like watching college basketball. It's like watching college basketball, which, let's go ahead and talk about that. I had this discussion last night with the great Bob Rathman, who is a play-by-play guy for the Hawks, but also does a ton of college basketball games and college baseball and college softball and WNBA, and Bob does everything.
College football, too.
College football. Bob does everything. If it's a sport and it comes on Fox Sports South, he does it, and he's the best. But... we were discussing this, and college basketball has so many things fundamentally wrong with it in the rules, but for me, and I think for you too, the number one thing's got to be the 35-second shot clock.
Oh, God, it is miserable. It's like you just see, like, teams, like, fail in, like, 3 different, like, types of, like, sets, and they still have time to run, like, another
fourth.
One. Yeah.
It's horrible. It's, I mean... There's always a constant argument going on Twitter and on whatever else about college basketball versus NBA basketball. And to be honest, the only redeemable thing about college basketball is if you have a tie to that school. Just from a watchability standpoint, it's really brutal. Like, I hate the lack of a defensive 3 seconds. Like, I understand arguments for why it's there, but I hate it. I think it clogs everything up and makes the game flow worse. I understand in college it's going to be hard to get people to get the refs to call it, because the refs in college basketball tend to be pretty awful, especially in the lower conferences. And then... it would change defenses completely because of the 2-3 zone, but that makes it rough to watch. But the shot clock makes it just almost – there's no flow to the game. There's so few possessions. If you watch a team like Wisconsin, they'll spend 20 seconds dribbling in the backcourt or dribbling behind the 5-second line.
Yeah, it's I mean, I think we were discussing this earlier. It's just like the most exciting teams, like in the NBA that we see, are the ones that push the pace and get up and down the floor a lot.
And that's in a 24-second shot clock.
Right.
Like, the ones you want to see, you know, we talk about the Knicks are rough to watch, the Bulls are rough to watch. And that's because it's a slow kind of grinding game. But that's on a 24-second shot clock. Like, if you have ever tried to watch a Wisconsin-Northwestern basketball game, it's almost not doable.
At least Wisconsin-Northwestern was the one that ended up with, like, the 36-33 game a couple of years ago, right?
Correct.
Okay.
I actually watched that game because I was with a Northwestern grad that was my boss, and it was such a brutal experience. So I think fixing the 35-second clock just kind of opens up a lot of other things, but just in general, the college game just needs to revisit a lot of stuff. I don't see why, like, Bob brought this up last night. If they are the only level of basketball that has a 35-second shot clock. The only one.
Right.
International, WNBA, women's game, NBA, any level they play with, like, 24. And there's no reason you can't play basketball in 24 seconds. There's no reason you can't operate an offense. There's not a valid reason for a 35-second clock. Especially if you're only going to play for 40 minutes. Like, I'm watching a game right now, and it's at least Kentucky and Florida are, like, pushing the pace, but Kentucky just scored a basket, and there's 26 seconds on the shot clock. Like, and that was in the half court. Like, why do you need 35 seconds? Why?
You really don't. You don't. And I think you said this last night. It's just like, why can't college basketball be like college football, where they experiment with several rule changes year by year? And they're willing to change, like, things year by year just to see what happens, almost.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, if college football can make a decision every year, like, they instituted that targeting rule, and then they realize that they made a fundamental error by not being able to review the penalty itself and pull the flag, and they made that change this year because it needed to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And college basketball needs to change the 35-second clock. I'm so vehemently against it that I rarely watch college ball. Like, I really do because of it, because it's rough to watch. College basketball is like Eastern Conference basketball all the time. There is no Western Conference basketball in college. Like, there is no, like, there are very few fun teams to watch. There are fun players to watch, but there are very few fun teams to watch. Like, Florida's pretty fun right now, but that's because they're getting shots with, like, 18 seconds on the shot clock.
Yeah, and I feel like it's kind of what you were saying. The only fun teams are college, really, because they have a fun player.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well,
it's like,
I mean,
Davidson used to be a fun team because they had Steph Curry.
Sure, and, like, BYU was so fun with Jimmer because he might pull up from 38.
Exactly.
If you don't have a guy who's a ridiculous three-point shooter or a supreme athlete like Jabari Parker or Andrew Wiggins, and don't tell me Jabari Parker's not an athlete. I watched him steal a ball and go coast-to-coast today and dunk from, like, middle of the lane over people. Like, there are fun players, but there are not many fun teams. Anyway, soapbox over. Let's go on to the fun Western Conference playoff race.
Yay, fun team.
So many good teams. The Suns beat the Raptors today.
They did.
They are now a game back of Memphis in the 8th seed, and also Dallas in the 7th seed. The West is so much fun. I feel like I keep saying this, but it's true.
I just want to point this out. Portland's 20 games above 500, and they're only 5 games ahead of the 9th seed.
Correct. Yes. Yes. That would put them solidly in the 3rd spot in the East. Like, by a lot. Actually,
Phoenix
would be the third.
Yeah.
Yes, 5 through 9 would all be the third seed in the East. But the East is big, man. Don't forget it. Memphis has had a resurgence since Marc Gasol came back.
Shocker.
Not surprisingly. They are, you know, they're just one of those kind of solid teams. the grit and grind, as they say out there. Courtney Lee's been huge for them.
Yes.
Because they needed someone that could just shoot, pretty much. Mike Miller just kind of wasn't doing it. Couldn't do it on his own, really, because he was their only shooter. When they have Miller and Lee on the floor, all of a sudden they have a little spacing, and their offense runs so much better. Mike Conley has driving lanes.
Spacing is big, man.
Spacing is big. The Mavs are still just doing their thing with, like, the oldest team in the league, it feels like. They, you know, Dirk is...
I'd love to see the Mavs in a playoff.
Dirk is healthy.
Just with anybody, just because anything could happen with Dirk and, like, Monta running pick and rolls for a whole game. Pick and roll, pick and pop.
Yeah.
I mean, Calderon
angering other point guards by being pesky.
They could score 140 per game in the playoffs and lose in six games.
Well, that, no, but I feel what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're ever going up against Dirk in a series, you have to be a little bit nervous. Just because if he gets hot for four games, you might lose. Like, he could drop. He's one of those guys that just, because he'll shoot over anybody. You can't defend him.
Exactly. And he'll...
He makes so many contested shots. Like, it's you know. So he's fun. And the Warriors are just ahead of them.
Only in transition a couple times a game.
Yeah. The Warriors are up there. Phoenix just... We had an interesting conversation in the thread today about what makes a season a success for Phoenix this year and whether they need to be in the playoffs or not. I don't think so. I think it would obviously you want to make the playoffs if you can, but for a team that had such low expectations, I think we often underrate the aspect of finding talent on your roster. Even for teams that are supposedly tanking or trying to be bad, if you're doing it kind of the right way in which you're evaluating talent and kind of finding, even if you're not finding like a star for the future, you might be finding a good role player you can hang on to,
mm-hmm.
Finding a young guy that you can develop. And I think Phoenix has found a ton of those guys.
Look at what Gerald Green's done this year. I mean, he essentially went from on his way out of the league to a contributing player on a possible playoff team.
Oh, yeah. You know, Green, Miles Plumlee. You found some role guys, the Morai twins. I think, you know, even if they end up in the 9 seed in the West, or, well, not the 9 seed, but the 9 spot in the West and miss the playoffs by a couple games. They still have plenty of draft picks this year.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get some good players.
Don't they have 3 first-rounders this year? Phoenix.
I think so. Something stupid like that. 2 or 3. And so they're going to get some talent. They obviously, they'll have multiple picks where they can move up if they want to. If some team's trying to maybe back down and get a couple picks.
Right.
Which, honestly, depending on where Philly ends up, if Philly ends up with, like, the fourth pick, I could totally see Hinkie swapping down for 2 picks.
Does Philly have 2 picks? Don't they have...
Philly already has 2 picks.
Yeah, they have New Orleans, have, too, don't they?
Yeah, because right now they'd have, like, the 2 or 3 and 11 if it turns out to be exact, which obviously the lottery never does. But if Phoenix... if Philly ends up dropping to, like, the 4 spot, I could totally see them going after a couple picks. So Phoenix could move up in a scenario like that.
Right.
Or they could just kind of sit pat and grab a couple more solid players. And they've got money, you know. They've got cap space. And I think the allure of Phoenix is better than a lot of those other kind of middling to lower level teams that have cap space. Because if nothing else, you can attract a star who's going to be kind of on his final big contract, the Carmelo or somebody like that, which I don't think Melo will leave to go there, but
yeah.
That's just kind of that age range where they can be like, look what we've done with these guys with as Andrew Lynch calls them, the Warlocks down there in this in the Phoenix medical staff. They have the best medical staff in the game, and that is, I think people underrate that as something players at that stage of their career will actually look at. Like, I could be there and have four or five really good years in Phoenix compared to maybe my body deteriorates a little worse somewhere else. Whatever they do down there in Phoenix, it works. It's got proven. I mean, you look at guys that leave there and all of a sudden just completely break down. Say, Steve Nash, Amari Stoudemire.
Are you going to see a, you know, 30, 31-year-old go to Chicago to get run in the ground for 2 years?
Fred cleared him. Fred cleared him. Yeah, I mean, seriously. It's something that guys look at. If the money's all even, which for most of these guys going for a max deal, the money's even if they leave their current team, then it is the little things. It's for some guys, it's winning. For some guys, it's going to be, you know, Phoenix might be able to sell a guy on possibly winning, but all, you know, but also the health aspect. So I think Phoenix is in a better spot than a lot of teams because they've found some young guys, Eric Bledsoe, Goran Dragic. They have point guards. They can kind of check that off. Like, we don't need to go after any point guards. We've got that set. You know, Jared Green might be a guy they can keep on the bench. He might be, you know, they might, looks like Hornacek's kind of found a way to get something out of him when no one else has.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can keep Jared Green as a Nate Robinson-y scorer off the bench. Obviously, he's not, but it's a different position, but that kind of scoring option.
Right.
And then Plumlee and those other guys, you've got possible bench guys, and you also have assets to move. So I don't think success necessarily this season for Phoenix has to be marked by playoff success. I think they found a really good coach in Jeff Hornacek. They know that now. And I think they also found some kind of gems that maybe they didn't know about. And I think it's what all these teams that are in the bottom are looking for. It's what the Bucks wanted to see out of Giannis this season. It's kind of why they cleared so much room for him. That's why they moved Caron Butler at the trade deadline. Was let's open up minutes for Giannis. Let's see what we have with him.
Right.
Philadelphia is just rotating guys in and out. I mean, that's essentially what they're doing. Is at this point, it's tryouts in Philly. They're going to lose, but they're trying guys out. They want to know, can we keep a guy like Hollis Thompson? Can we keep a guy like, you know, I think they just optioned Arnett Moultrie to the 87ers. But, you know, they're just trying these guys out, see what they got. And I think that's where a lot of these teams are. Boston's doing that. Orlando's doing that. And Phoenix has done it better than anybody else this season.
We're talking about Gerald Green. So, speaking of him, talking about, like, a most improved player candidate.
Yeah. Well, I think this is another thing that got talked about in the thread today. We kind of wanted to bring up the award races. So I guess we can mosey on into that. But most improved player, I think the problem with that award is I don't understand the definition of it or how other people define it. I think there's so many people that define it. It's kind of like MVP. Like, some people are like the best player on the best team, the best player in general. Most improved, it's like, what level does the guy have to be at? Because that general title, I mean, and you look at who's won it in the past, it's probably not actually the most improved player. It seems to be the guy who maybe plays the most.
The guy who really improved last season and got more minutes because of it, so now he's the same player as he was last
correct.
Year, but his numbers
Paul George last, Paul George last year and these guys. Like, so I think, you know, Matt and some other people were talking about DeMar DeRozan, which I would be fine with. He's been really terrific, but again, it's like, you know.
He's one of the, I think he's on one of the better teams almost. He's on a three team.
He is.
So.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that doesn't count, but I mean, he's on a three seed.
Right. He's on three seeds, so, you know, DeRozan's up there, but, you know, I think you kind of have to put guys like Joe Green, at least think about them.
Right.
Yeah, the same as Lance Stephenson last year should have gotten more consideration than he did. These guys that go from almost out of the league to quality role players, I mean, honestly, if he had played more early in the season, I could totally see Kendall Marshall getting some talk for it.
Right.
Because, I mean, this is a guy that couldn't stick on, like, two or three different teams. And now all of a sudden he's out here, like, one of the better assist men in the league.
Obviously, that's part of a credit to D'Antoni's offensive system.
Total
just,
credit.
I mean, just being able to run up the floor and just do everything and pile up numbers.
Yeah, but,
I mean, that's just such a weird thing that he would have success in this system that well and not be able to stick somewhere else.
Yeah, I think part of it was he was in some poor situations. Washington was a terrible spot for him.
Right.
Because Washington's offense is so kind of just create for yourself type stuff. Like John Wall, it's just like kind of create for himself and kick out.
Yep.
Whereas Kendall seems to be much better running just kind of a lot more motion where he doesn't have to necessarily penetrate but use his vision to see open guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was talking to Darvin Ham, who coached in LA last year with D'Antoni. And I asked him about Kendall Marshall. And he was saying that D'Antoni's system is just super easy for guys to pick up. This was after that game where they won, where Bazemore and Marshawn Brooks had huge games in a win over, I think it was Boston. And I was like, why are guys able to pick this offense up so quickly? He's like, it's just intuitive. It's simple. Everything is just read and react off of, it all works off of like the point guard's move.
Mm-hmm.
If the point guard does this, then you do this. Like, it's very, he said it's like incredibly simple. So for Marshall, it's simple. He makes a move. He knows where guys are going to go. He doesn't have to worry about this or that. And so I think that's what helps him, and that's what's helped so many guards in D'Antoni's system become maybe better than they are or just produce better than they would in anywhere else. But for most improved, I think it'll probably be DeRozan. Dragic has been great, too. Yeah, he should deserve
that talk. Looked like a completely different player. You could legitimately say for the first part of the season he was in the MVP conversation with how well Phoenix was playing.
Yeah.
And which is ridiculous to them. He's averaging something like 20-7. Like.
Yeah, he's been great. He's been so good. And it's, we were looking back at our predictions from the HP preview. I didn't do so good with those. I think I had Derek Favors for most improved, which, no.
I had Kawhi, because I thought his numbers would go up a lot, but he got hurt.
Yeah.
His numbers are kind of static.
It's better than both of us picking Lou Williams for sixth man of the year. When he's been benched for a week and a half.
Yeah.
Lou. Who do you got for sixth man? Taj?
I think it's Taj. I mean, I guess Manu's actually still having a pretty good year.
I think Manu's like that perennial, like, you can make a case.
I mean, I was about to say, we all thought he was going to die after the finals. And he's come back and put up a pretty solid rebound year.
Yeah, everybody wrote Manu off after those finals. He looked so bad. I mean, he just looked like a corpse on the court. Like, he couldn't move. He was very non-Manu-like in his movements. But he's come back. Just like the Spurs have come back when nobody thought they would. As long as Duncan's there and Pop's there, I refuse to just... I'm just going to pick them to win the West every year.
I'm trying to think. What was... I think I predicted the Spurs to win like 54, and I think that they're at like 48.
Yeah, I'm a pencil them in for like 58 games and the number one seed in the West every year. I'm tired of getting burned on this every season. Eventually they're going to age, right?
At some point,
they
you think
to.
So.
Like when Duncan's 57, he's finally going to break down. It's bound to happen. The T-Wolves are, going back to the Western playoff race, we kind of meandered out of that, but Minnesota's 500 and they're pretty much out of it at this point.
Yeah, they're five back.
It's so sad because they would be the 7 in the East.
Hey, the East is improving. I think 500 in the East would have been about, what, 5 a couple of months ago?
4.
Yeah, because it was just the Hawks and then Pacers and Heat for a while.
Yeah, East is coming back. It's a comeback season for the East. 2014 is going to be a new year, man.
Yep.
It's happening. It's all happening. Let's talk about the Trailblazers. Talk about your favorite topic. LaMarcus Aldridge, a little banged up right now, but they're still 20 games over 500. You were saying if he's out for an extended period of time, you could see them.
It
possibly
looks like he's not going to be. I mean, they have I think he's out. I think he's out tonight.
Okay.
End of the day, I think. But in that case, I mean, I could see it, but if he turned out to be out for a while, mm-hmm. I mean, they are 5 games up, but in 5 games in the West, if you lose someone like LMA, seems like it could turn to hell very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely could. And it's kind of funny you're saying that, because you're not exactly the biggest LMA guy.
I mean, he's a really good player, but it's just kind of like when he got in that MVP conversation earlier in the year. It's just like, I still don't think this guy is even better than Al Horford.
Right.
So it's one of those things, it's just like people are comparing him to Love just because he's putting up raw stats. And I'm like, he's taking 21 shots to get 23 points. It's so, like,
he takes, I'm going to pull it up real quick. I got to pull up his mid-range shot attempts are so amazing. Like,
okay.
I remember last year.
I'm looking at it right now. His true shooting is .507. Like, we were killing Josh Smith last year for putting up a true shooting.
Yeah.
Like, 2 years ago, and during the lockout season, when Josh was essentially the lead guy on the Hawks, we were killing him for that sort of number, and here we're talking about LMA as an MVP candidate.
Mm-hmm. Josh is at a strong, like, 46%.
Yeah, this year.
Solid. Rock solid. And so he was at, like, 45.9 before he had a game where he made, like, 3 3-pointers. Just putting in work, bringing it up.
I mean, for a reference for people, I think the league average true shooting is about 53%, 54%.
Yeah.
So it's always weird to me to see, like, someone considered an MVP candidate when they're below that.
Mm.
I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you.
Also, curse you, Robbie, for bringing up this topic. I knew you were going to do it eventually.
Are you such a hater, Bo?
Hate everything.
You
next
hate it
podcast,
all.
You're going to bring up Rajon Rondo for 20 minutes.
You want to talk about Rondo?
Let's not talk about Rondo because I don't have anything to talk about Rondo right now.
Oh, all right. Fine.
I haven't watched Boston in forever, so I couldn't even tell you how he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, neither have I. They're relatively irrelevant at this point. They're not near the bottom. I watched the Hawks game, and that was about it. Let's talk about what's going on with the Pacers and the Heat. Let's go there. They're both kind of in a weird skid right now.
And it's usually the opposite around this time.
Right.
You usually see those top teams start to get in the gear and
do what
killing
the
folks. Yeah.
But yeah, it's very strange, especially to see the Heat doing this at this time of the year.
I think what LeBron said were, you know, Wade's back in the lineup more. I think there's some legitimacy to that, to why he struggled, and to why the team struggled, because now, like, everybody's role's in flux with how many games Wade's missed. Because it's sort of like, okay, he's playing, now he's not playing, so you have to do so many different things in between games to, like, what your actual role is in the offense.
Yeah.
I think it can make it harder to, like, okay, now we're this. You might have to actually get used to having something more defined. And that could be a cause of their struggle. But they still have been kind of, I mean, even then, it's just kind of seemed like, well, they should still be doing better than they've been doing recently.
Yeah, they just haven't looked Heat-like recently. They're making mistakes that they don't normally make, just kind of like mental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That you rarely see Miami do, which is, it's just weird to watch teams like that struggle when you're so used to seeing them dominate. And, you know, you see them have off shooting nights, but you rarely see them have kind of nights where LeBron's making bad passes and they're playing out of control and, you know, they look out of sync. And it might speak to what you're talking about, where the rules kind of change and maybe how they play changes a little bit when they have certain lineups in.
That reminds me, when I was on a Piston Powered Live earlier this year with Jam Draper, and they were playing the Heat, and I was talking about it. I was just like, this is so weird. I don't ever expect, like, the Heat to lose. Like, it's one of the, like, yeah. At that point, it's like that. I never expected, like, the Heat. I always, like, predict the Heat to win their game. And now it's just I'm not, like, quite as sure right now because it kind of looked weird.
Oh, my God. All right, so this just pulled up, finally. The media site running slow as usual. But LaMarcus Aldridge has taken 786 mid-range shots this year.
Good Lord.
Carmelo Anthony is second at 637.
Jesus.
And Dirk has taken 581, and he's in third. Like, Suge Knight, that is a lot. And he's only shooting 42%.
On mid-range?
Yes.
That's not good.
And Dirk shoots 50%. I mean, because he's ridiculous.
42% is like slightly above league average, I think, on mid-range.
Yeah, it's about league. I mean, for a guy that takes that many, like Melo makes 44.
I mean, yeah, there's a certain like different level to it when you're taking that many. I mean, mm-hmm. It's greater difficulty to maintain that rate, but still, that's not.
Yeah, I mean, but
I guess it does work for their offense because people guard him against that so much.
Yeah,
and it opens up things for everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, he shoots the same from the mid-range as Paul George. For whatever that's worth. Mid-range shooting numbers are so weird. Like, Ibaka's really good. Steph Curry's really good, but Steph Curry's really good.
Where's Chris Bajush Bosh on that list?
Bajush. Bosh hasn't really taken that many mid-range shots, apparently. He's not even in the top 25. Which is weird. I think, Bosh is one of those guys that he's accepted the analytics stuff. And you see him, like, he consciously takes two steps back when he pops to get behind the three-point line.
Yeah, he's been taking more threes lately, that is true.
Oh, Josh Smith, strong 35.2%.
That seems like an improvement from last year, I feel like.
It is.
I feel like last year was like 32 or something.
Except his three-point percentage is just not good. How has Josh taken 220 three-pointers?
I remember we were killing him last year.
He has taken 50 more three-point attempts than Rudy Gay.
Wow.
50. He's taken, this is kind of fun, actually. He's taken almost 100 more threes, 70 more threes than Monte Ellis. Bosh is at 48%.
Okay.
From mid-range. And he's shooting like 38% from three. Why not? Because he's Chris Bosh. Like a Bosh. Deion Waiters shoots the exact same as LaMarcus Aldridge. There we go. From mid-range. That'll warm Conrad's heart. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to maintain when you take that many, but if you're taking that many, you should probably shoot a little better than league average. That's just a thought. If you're going to, like, hoist that many. And the thing is Aldridge is, like, a relatively athletic dude for a power forward as big as he is.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think he would kind of add that pump and drive. It's something that Horford worked on last year. He said that was a big part of what he tried to add to his game.
Right.
And you would think that LMA should probably add that step because he just kind of hoists. Like he, I, you rarely see him hit a jab step and pump, and then go. Whereas you know you see a lot of guys like even like guys like Kevin Love and these guys that can shoot. I think they kind of realize it's not a great shot. And if they can get better, they're going to get better. And I almost never see LaMarcus even think about looking for a different shot. He's just like, I caught it. This is my spot. Hoist. So I'd like to see more guys kind of that have that ability.
I think another weird thing about Aldridge is he takes so many mid-range shots, but only has taken like 14 threes this year. You think at some point he'd find himself like in the corner or like, at like above the break more often with how far away he is from the basket.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's a conscious effort because for so long big men were kind of told
you can't go
to the mid range. Yeah. Like you don't shoot threes. Like that used to be it, and now there's you know, and it depends on the team. And it depends on kind of where their I wouldn't even say their analytics department, but kind of where their coaching staff is as far as embracing stuff like that. Like even like you see, you know, obviously Chris Bosh is and Paul Millsap doing it this year. Whereas Millsap never took 3-pointers ever in Utah, but that was because he was told not to, essentially. Like he was never asked to. And big men, it's not the first thing they think of. You kinda have to
put it in their mind. Make a conscious effort for it.
Yeah. Oh, look at Big Baby. Sorry, I just saw Big Baby's numbers, and they're about LaMarcus's. Anywho, what were we talking about?
Yeah, where are we going with this?
I don't know. I just like to look at mid-range numbers because it's kind of fun.
Josh is drawn towards mid-range numbers.
Yeah. Oh, man. And Brandon Jennings is shooting 34% from the mid-range. The Pistons. Pistons basketball. Pistons basketball. Ooh, LeBron's only shooting 39%. Not clutch. Not clutch. But, anyway, we talked kind of what's going on with the Heat. The Pacers, since acquiring Andrew Bynum and Evan Turner, not so good.
No, not really.
Not so good. Yeah. Not doing, but they're not really losing ground because the Heat are also, you know, not so good.
And of course, no one else in the
league. I like how I'm talking about a 49-17 team being not so good recently. Sure. But yeah, I mean, I think, I'm not sure what Evan Turner really, I think it's kind of like the Wade thing. Evan Turner's kind of throwing off their normal flow.
Them trading, I think they're
trying to find minutes for him because he's one of those guys that in your head you're like, okay, he deserves X amount of minutes. But then again, when you have Lance and maybe you're taking minutes away from Lance the way he's playing and Paul George, like, do you really need to be finding Evan 25, 30 minutes a game?
Here's a stat too. In 9 games in March, Roy Hibbert's averaging 8.7 points and 4.6 rebounds.
That's not good.
Obviously, we know his defensive impact is enormous, and it's
but
still, I mean, you
want to get.
You can't, I mean, he's playing 30 minutes too, so it's. I mean,
that's not. How is he making 5 boards a game?
Not even in that time.
That makes no sense.
Yeah.
How is he only? He's only averaging 7 boards a game for the year. Yeah,
I mean, Paul George kind of hurts that because he has good rebounding people at each position next to him. You know, all the way from George Hill, Lance, and Dave West.
Yeah. I mean, you got Bynum.
Bynum putting up 18 shots.
What are you doing? This isn't practice in Cleveland where you can just hoist from 30. What is he doing? 18 shots?
20 minutes.
That's like me in a pickup game.
Just without the ultra mean screens.
You don't want to get caught with one of my screens. Bad news bears. But, yeah. Like, what is Bynum even... Why? Why is he taking 18 shots? In 20 minutes.
I don't understand.
That bothers me. Like, I don't even understand how that's possible. Yeah, I mean, I think Indiana, the difference between them and a lot of these really good teams is I don't think they know how to be a really good team. And that sounds weird, but they haven't done it before, really. You know, last year they kind of came on late.
I mean, they won, what, 49 games last year? I mean, that's good, but it's not like, you know, it's not, they don't know how to contend, I guess. They don't know how to be a contender.
What I'm saying by that is I don't think they know how to pace themselves through a season. Mm-hmm. They came out on fire early in the season. I mean, they were torching teams. And they expended a ton of energy doing that. It's a long season. It's a grind of a season. Guys get banged up. Guys get injured. And kind of expelling that much energy when you had Paul George playing as many minutes as he was and Hibbert and all these guys, if you're going to kind of tire them, you know. I mean, managing minutes and managing energy is something that the best teams do. Nobody does it better than the Spurs. You know, I think we joke a lot about Pop and the DNP old and stuff like that, which is still the best thing I've ever seen. And, but, you know, and there's arguments whether you need to do that or you don't need to do that. You know, Stan Van Gundy obviously was not a proponent of that at that Sloan panel he did.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's something to it. I think the Heat do it. You see the Heat kind of, you know, they pedaled the gas a little bit in the middle of the year. You know, LeBron might not go full flying death machine all the time. You know, maybe you take a little bit off. Maybe you go at 80-90% so that you're not expending all that energy. So when you can peak at the right time, and there's definitely something to peaking at the end of the season compared to game 50.
Right.
And I think the Pacers peaked at like game 40. At this point, I don't know if they can get it back. I don't know if they have that switch. The Spurs are, right now, the Spurs are coming on at the right time.
I think you're on the right track. I mean, we were looking at it earlier in the season. I mean, really, all of their players peaked at the same time. With the way Paul George was shooting, the way Lance was doing, the way, you know, Roy Hibbert was playing. And they've all just kind of, like, hit a slump at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that they'll, you know, get it back together, like either that or a couple of players will get it back together, and they'll be back on track. But
I think I'm not sitting here saying they're going to get upset in the first or second round. I still think they're an Eastern Conference Finals team, but this season there's a little less to that than normal.
I mean, it's just the way.
But I just don't. You know, I think early in the season we were talking about them as kind of the favorites in the East, and I don't have that feeling at all now. I think it's. I feel very comfortable saying it's Miami, even though Miami's kind of going through a little slump right now. And I don't want to get narrative-y, but Miami knows what they're doing in a way that Indiana might not.
But the way I was looking at it earlier in the year is like whoever came out of the East was going to win. And now I'm really not so sure of that with the way the Spurs and the Thunder and the Clippers.
We need to talk about the Thunder. We do need to talk about the Thunder. With Russell Westbrook back, plenty of talk about whether they're better without Russ, which is so dumb.
Yeah.
So incredibly dumb. The Thunder, that's a fun basketball team.
Absolutely.
It's disgusting.
It's like every... I mean, they're... I guess people kill them for being a really big isolation team. But they have such the best players to do that. They just watch KD and Russell work, like, all the game.
But the thing is, and here's my thing about the way they do a lot of their isolation stuff. They are getting into isolation they play a lot of isolation game, but at the same time, I think
they pass out of it really well when it's not going well, I think.
Right, they pass out of doubles. You know, Russ will get a little tunnel vision and take a bad shot every once in a while, but you let Westbrook be Westbrook, as we always say. And
Westbrook.
Because he might pull up from 38 and make one. That was ridiculous. Or dunk from, like, just inside the free throw line. But I love what they do. I think they're a really solid defensive team. Despite, you know, they might not have, you know, Ibaka's still a really good defender. I think we take for granted what he does at this point.
I think Ibaka's underrated on defense at this point just because where he used to be overrated on it. Because he's legitimately improved on that, and I think some people have sort of missed that.
He's gone the way that a lot of young shot blockers go when they improve. Josh Smith did this in Atlanta. The block numbers might go down a little bit, and the highlight defensive plays go down a little bit, but if you watch Ibaka's positioning and footwork on defense now, it is vastly improved from where he was. And he's learned how to pick his spots. He doesn't jump for stuff as much. You used to be able to pump fake Ibaka out of his shoes.
Right.
If you were in the post and you gave him a little up and under, you could draw a foul on him. He has learned how to time his stuff better. He stays on the floor. And that is an underrated aspect of becoming a good defender when you're a blocked shot guy and you're such a high-energy, athletic dude. Learning how to kind of maybe take that athleticism down and make that less a part of your defensive game is, you know, and I talked to Josh about this a couple of years ago and how his big thing was maybe not letting athleticism be the biggest thing he used and being more of a cerebral guy. I think you're seeing Ibaka do that.
Yeah, I mean, he's just so impressive to me now, just where he was when he almost won Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah. And his offensive game has become so good. I mean, he's lethal as a jump shooter.
Right.
And he still can cut to the basket and dunk all over people, but he's a lethal jump shooter. He's gotten a corner three-point shot as part of his arsenal. He's a legitimately terrifying power forward to play. I think we get so caught up in with all of the really good power forwards in this league, he kind of gets lost in the mix, but he is a young, really good power forward.
I mean, I guess I'm going to go there, and I don't know, I guess maybe we can end on this sort of, but I think that, I mean, when you look at it, what the decision Oklahoma City had to make in terms of their cap on whether to keep Harden or Ibaka, really, is what it was coming down to. I guess, I mean, I think they really made the right decision there, because they had to have someone play defense on that team, and he's doing it extremely well at this point. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think if it really was that decision that had to be made, I think you have to move hard. And they got some good pieces out of it. Obviously, Jeremy Lamb's playing well for them. You know, and they've got some good young guys. That, honestly, everybody on that team is young.
Didn't they get... where did their Stephen Adams pick come from?
I don't even remember. They've made a lot of really good trades to get weird picks out of... I don't think that was the Houston trade. Was it?
Houston Rockets as a future 2013 first-round pick with Jeremy Lamb and Kevin Martin to Oklahoma City, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because that's right, because they held on to Terrence Jones and traded the future.
Houston got that from the Raptors first. And then flipped it to OKC.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And the Thunder, a Thunder Spurs series would just be terrific at this point. Really, it's funny. Every time.
Any two Western Conference teams would be.
Any two Western Conference teams are playing each other, I feel like Twitter's like, oh, we need this as a series. It doesn't matter who's playing each other. Like, it just doesn't. It's like, oh, Warriors-Rockets, we need this. And I'm like, really? We're going to be blessed no matter what Western Conference matchups we get. Like, that first round in the Western Conference is going to be so much fun. and the East is going to be so depressing. Like, I keep going, but the Eastern Conference playoff matchups are so bad right now. Toronto-Brooklyn's by far the best, as it stands today. And that doesn't say much.
Chicago-Washington would be ugly.
God. I would feel, dude, Whitman trying to coach against Thibs would just be unfair. That's not, that we would need
we'll
to
get,
like,
we'll
I would make
a great Joakim Noah Griffiths in that series, but otherwise that's going to be
yeah, pretty much. I mean, unless we need a steady cam on Yannick in the corner.
Have we gone, we just went full circle on our podcast. We started off with the Eastern Conference playoff race. We're back there.
Everything leads back to the East because the East is big, man. It's got gravitational pull. So, anyway, this has been an enlightening podcast, I guess.
It really has been.
Always good, Bo. Thank y'all for listening. You can read us on Hardwood Paroxysm and also myself at Hawks.com, Bo at Hawks Hoop. And until next time, good basketballing.